This episode is brought to you by Not Alone Co. It has been such a pleasure for us at Not Alone Co. to create our little Not Alone community. We want to be able to utilize the messaging on our apparel in order to help facilitate tough and meaningful conversations with your loved ones. Community, conversation, and vulnerability. This is a journey, and mental health isn't a battle to be won. We at Not Alone Co. are here to remind you that you are never alone, and it's okay to not be okay. Use code NAC10 at checkout for 10% off your order, which helps us donate portions of the proceeds to various mental health charities and foundations. That's code NAC10 at checkout. We love you, and you're not alone. Well, hello and welcome, everybody, to the Speaker Man podcast, but we're going to get to that in a little bit. Riley, I got a hard-hitting question for you. So Riley and I were both at weddings on the weekends. I had the absolute pleasure of officiating the wedding and saying the, you know, for the first time ever, please help me congratulate. It was kind of cool. I think you were just a spectator at the wedding. That's always kind of a nice where you can just, you know, see everything, have some fun. But my question is, ceremony's over. Everybody's cocktail hours are over. Feeling good. Chairs open up, tables open up, the dance floor is all of a sudden glistening, just like waiting for you. But you have that little bit of restraint of like, okay, I need a song, I need something. I don't want Keisha to pull me up. Like I wanna go up on my own. Like, what is your song that you hear and you're like, holy shit, like I need to be on the dance floor right now. There's a button that might come down and I am going to tear it up.
Oh God. Okay. So when we were talking about questions, I thought you were going to just say like the one that like when I'm already like mid dance floor, that gets me extra fired up.
Okay. Well, that
so I feel like it's, yeah. So I'll answer first, like a song that'll get me out there.
It's a tough one. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I would say like maybe like a little like Pitbull.
Time of Our Lives. That was mine.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Like Pitbull, Sean Paul. Yeah, like I go back to like my college days, like Akon. Yeah. I mean, I pardon my French. I think it was "Sexy Bitch" was the one song I remember by Akon. Like, so yeah, those ones definitely, the Pitbull or Sean Paul. But I'm not like a classic wedding songs person on the dance floor. Like, I want to hear like more like throwback, like some '90s rap, some, you know, 2000s rap, some like Pitbull, like I said, like some Neo maybe.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Some Usher. But the one song though that is like a classic, like everybody just sings their heart out, that I have good memories with, is Mr. Brightside. I remember I have a video of Mr. Brightside. All my buddies picked me up at the wedding and were throwing me up and down, and everyone was just singing their heart out. So it had some good memory to that song. But what about you?
I don't know why, but that is the most, like, you, yeah, like, Mr. Brightside, The Killers, like, I could be in any situation with any group of friends, and you got to belt it out. You know, I instantly thought that Time of Our Lives by Pitbull, but I'm going to, you know what's honestly a good one? Raise Your Glass by Pink. My mom, shout out to my mom for that one. She loves Pink. I think that's one that just, it has to get you going. And one that I will just always sing to, and I think everybody on the dance floor will always sing to, is definitely a little KOL. You Somebody, I think, is always. Oh, God.
I was like, KOL. I had to put that together.
Sorry, yeah. Kings of Leon?
Yeah.
It will always be at the top of my list. It's just, yeah.
It's a good one.
I can't hit the chorus as well as they do, but, you know, I do love singing that. Okay, so now on to yours. Now we're on the wedding talk.
Yeah. So song, first dance song. I mean, I've experienced my first dance, but we had a long list of possibilities. So actually our top three, two of them got picked by two of our closest friends. So we had Leon Bridges, Beyond, and then I'm With You, Vance Joy. And then we picked James Bay, If I Ain't Got You, Alicia Keys remix. Obviously Alicia Keys has a good one too, but hey.
Is that Slater, man?
Yeah, you want to come say hi quick?
1, 2, 3. Here he is.
Hey,
can you wave?
Hi, Slater.
Okay, you gotta go because we're doing the podcast intro.
Yeah. So those are three. We landed on James Bay. What about you?
So I'm currently going through my country playlist because I don't know, it doesn't have to be country. My instant one that I actually sent, so there's one friend, we just send songs back and forth. Like we won't talk for 2 weeks and then all of a sudden I just get a song and then we'll just like, you know, shoot the shit for a little bit and then a week later a song, 3 days later a song. So I sent him this song called In My Sheets by John Vincent III. It sounds... Yeah,
we got that one on our Spotify. Keisha, I think, put it on.
There you go. It is immaculate. And it just, mm-hmm. I could be in the car. I listened to it this morning at 5:30 a.m. on the way to work. Like, it's just, just chef's kiss. Chef's kiss.
Do you play a song like that over and over? Or do you get sick of it after a while because you play it too much?
So what I usually do is I'll make a playlist of like probably 15 to 20 songs that I'm currently vibing with. And I will play with that playlist quite often, but I still try to work in some of my old playlists to not make it feel like Kat, every time Kat gets in the car, it's the same five songs. But the other one that I kind of thought about is Holy by Florida Georgia Line. High on Loving You. I think that is a phenomenal tune. But anyways, I have had enough talk about proposing marriage weddings in my life lately. Shout out to my lovely future mother-in-law, not yet, but Darlene, she's been hounding me. Anyways, it is time for another episode of the Speak Your Mind podcast, and we are delighted that you're here with us today, and we had an excellent guest on. His name is Rainier Wild. Wow. The insight, thought-provoking. The guy is just a stellar look to him, with the hat, the beard, the hair, all around. Just a really excellent podcast, and I think we both were able to learn a lot, and I think the best part about the podcast is sometimes you come in with expectations, sometimes you don't, sometimes you come in just free, sometimes you're just, you know, just want to see how it goes. And I think for both of us, we wanted to just see how this flowed. And for us, especially when we got into the fatherhood talk, we got into a lot of things, I think we could both relate. And he offered something that, once again, sometimes not everybody offers to you. And that's all I have right now because I just went on a ramble. So Riley, how did you like Rainier?
No, he was great. It was awesome. That last part about the emotional stability, that was powerful stuff and hit home for me. And I think can sort of hit home for a lot of people. I mean, it's a hard thing to navigate through, but I think we can all use a little bit of strengthening in our emotional stability. So yeah, he was awesome. Really, really cool guy. Sick name, sick style. Yeah, like you said, I wasn't really sure what we were kind of going to talk about. I didn't even really get around to asking many of my questions. The conversation just came organically, and it was a lot of fun.
So yes, please enjoy our boy Rainier. And y'all, please go check out Speak Your Mind Instagram. We are doing our best to keep you guys intrigued, keep you guys involved. And whether it's New Tune Tuesday, whether it's Lick and Kick Fridays, or whether it's a upcoming segment that we can't reach about yet. Just, you never know. And please, go check it out. We love y'all. Speak your mind. And we will see you again soon. Well, Rainier, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on. I wish I was as big of a reader as you, judging from that bookcase. Is that always how you've been?
Yeah, I wasn't even allowed to watch television till I was 11 years old. So no TV, no movies. I started reading at about 3 and a half, reading books. And I actually remember why. And I don't think this is just apocryphal. I think that actually I do recall the event. What happened was I loved this one book that my mother would read. And I asked her to read this one book over and over and over. It happened to be The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe from the Chronicles of Narnia. Yeah. And of course, there's six other books besides that one. And she was eager to move on. And my siblings were eager for her to move on. But I was not. I was very addicted to Mr. Tumnus and Lucy and and the White Witch. I wanted all of those. And I remember when she said, if you want me to read this book one more time, you're going to have to learn how to read it yourself. And I remember getting out the big picture book and staring at it and asking one of my older siblings, what's that mean? And I kind of pieced together through repetition of having had it read to me so many times what those words meant. So I taught myself how to read very early on.
Love that. Oh, that's cool. That's good too. Like at a young age, that's pretty common, right? For kids is like, I have a 1.5 year old and I'm noticed. I mean, it's always, I mean, that's a little younger than 3, 3.5 like you said, but the consistency is really important to him and the repetition is really important to him. I don't know how much work you do with children and understanding the psychology with children, but I mean, you may be able to speak on kind of why that is important. Cause I kind of, now that we're talking about it, I wonder the science behind it.
Science behind repetition. I think that's an interesting thing. I'm not 100% sure that I could speak directly to that myself, but I'm first of all, I'm a father 4 times over. So I'm sitting here
so
thinking
your experience.
I've at least witnessed this 4 times on my own. But actually my undergraduate was in human development. And so before I went on and got my master's in psychology, I was already very interested in how do humans do this humaning thing. I think I've always been kind of curious, you know, how do we grow? How do we develop? How do we evolve? And I think one thing that's interesting when I look back on some of these things, and I'm kind of hearing you talk about this a little bit too, is our language centers come on, depending on who we are, roughly around the same time every time as humans, which is about just about 3 years old. Right? It can be earlier, it could be a little later, but roughly around 3 years old, we see our language centers kind of begin to click on inside of our minds. And that means that we become this repetitive sponge where we're actually giving back the language that has been put into us. We're able now to communicate, to speak in that way. Now, what's fascinating is there's a couple of other things that happen right around the same time. Not only do our language centers come on, but also our personality. You know, I've watched 4 grow up and they kind of become human at around 3. I mean, I hate to say it like that, but as a father, my wife was very attached to them from the moment they were conceived. They were growing inside of her. I was not so attached. You know, it took me a while. And by 3, they're human. Like they are a fully functional participant in this civilization project. And that's important to know that right around that same age as language is firing in them, their personalities are also coming online. And that tells us something. It tells us how conditioned we are by the language that we are absorbing and then we'll perform back from. Now, why that's important. Where do we learn language? Well, we learn it from our parents. We learn it from our circumstances. But ultimately, language is the codification of your culture. By 3 years old, your personality has already been programmed by the culture around you.
Yeah, and there's so many things that are uncontrollable, right? Like you can have the proper language that's ingrained in you by your parents and your siblings, but then there's like, you know, there's so much else going on around you. So that's actually kind of wild and scary to think about.
Yeah. And of course it takes time and over time, more layers of your personality. But what I would call the most fundamental, most basic part of the human persona, the human personality or ego structure starts right around that. And it is programmed by the society, the culture around us. Through language. And one of the evidences of this actually to me is something that most kids don't learn, but every kid does right around that same age, which is lie. you know, I used to work in this line of field and I would have parents come to me and be like, oh my God, my 5-year-old is lying to me all the time. What the hell is wrong with them? And I kind of chuckle and go, oh wow, they're doing something right, right? They're working. Because what lying means is that a child is able to imagine into your experience and take their experience and measure it against yours. and then tell you what you want to hear. I mean, it's a really phenomenal little psychological mechanism. So it means that they've developed to an appropriate level. But nobody taught them lying. So where'd they learn it? Why does every kid know lying? It's because lying, deception, is hidden in language itself. Culturally, we are built on avoidance of reality. You don't have to teach it. It's in the language. Now, here's where it gets even more interesting. The other day, my son, who's 18, showing me technology these days, Chat GPT or whatever that's called. Oh, yeah. I can never get the initials right. And he's showing me it. And you know, it ran into some roadblocks. Like he went to type in, he said, "Dad, watch this." And he said, "Tell me how to destroy the world." And you know, like my 18-year-old son is clearly a, you know, he's a mad genius. And so do you know what the AI said? Said, "I cannot tell you about this. I cannot talk about this. I'm a friend to humanity," whatever that, you know, boilerplate is. We're already teaching artificial intelligence how to avoid reality. Isn't that interesting? We're already teaching that which comes after us, right? How to do that thing which is so essential to our humaning, which is avoiding reality as it is. Avoiding truths that are unpleasant, avoiding uncomfortable things, right? Is that, and of course, I don't want it to actually go there either. I'm reinforcing it too.
So like, how does this, I listened to you talk about this kind of before, and like just when we were kind of just doing a little bit of research, and you kind of describe it as like it's a defense mechanism, right? Is that how you would sort of describe it? Like
lying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Avoidance of reality is probably the mother of all of our defense mechanisms or coping strategies.
Because if it's a survival thing, like you need it, right? But how do you use it in a healthy way, if that makes sense? And like, how do you have the right conversations to also bring out, you know, like to not always resort back to that mechanism?
I think anyone who doesn't know the word mindfulness right now is living under a peculiar kind of rock. Mindfulness, presence, awareness, this has been in the common conversation for at least the last 40 years, I think. Probably a little longer considering the counterculture. But I think that it's gained kind of a fevered pitch right now. I think it does miss something, and so I appreciate your question. What I think that sometimes presence misses, or awareness misses, or wokeness misses, is we can't always be awake. God, have you met people who are always awake? People who are always awake are insane. They're really miserable to be around. They don't even like themselves, right? You come to that certain point where you're like, please just go to sleep. Oh my God. Humans are not made to always be in the hyper reality of the present. Actually, we have these wonderful mechanisms of looking away, of being distracted, of not being aware. There's a kind of Alzheimer's of the present, I'll call it. If we were constantly riveted in our attention to this moment, we would lose track of our past, we would lose focus onto where we want to go, our future. We would really become almost a swamp without any clear channel or direction. And we must, in fact, have a direction. So our mind actually does create these tricks of attention where it turns off, it shuts off anything that isn't relevant to what it thinks it needs right now to get through. That's the defense mechanism. So how can I use that to serve me? Well, I would call this mindful distraction. I would allow myself the opportunity of going to sleep. I would say, I'm going to sleep now. And I know this is sleep. Have you ever been in a dream where you didn't know if it was reality or a dream?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Sometimes those really can frighten you. And how you get out of those is you say, I'm dreaming. On the other hand, sometimes you're in a dream that's very sweet and you don't completely want to pull out of it, but you still are aware you're dreaming. And so you say, I'm dreaming. Oh, this feels nice. Go back to sleep, buddy. In either case, it's important that maybe you know you're dreaming. So what I would say in this is that one of the values is know when you're giving yourself over to the story. So these are little ways of working with yourself. Say like, yeah, the story I'm telling myself is. Allow yourself to know that you're living in subjective truth. Like, I'm not convinced that I'm telling the truth all the time. I'm not convinced that I'm living in reality. In fact, it is my ability to know I'm not living in reality, just my perception, that enables me to play and to give color and dimension and creativity to things. So I think there's a lot of wiggle room there, but it's contingent on knowing when I'm lying, knowing when I'm truthing.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. A lot of self-awareness involved there. Okay. So, wow. That was, what a start. And I would like to talk about your start. Like, where, obviously you talked about, your undergrad and, your master's. Like, is this something that you have always been infatuated by? Like, just how humans are able to, you know, process things, how humans are able to work? Like, is this, you know, going back to even before your university and then coming out of university after everything you were able to teach yourself and learn? I guess, how has that transition been, you know, since before with your interests and now really being able to mentor and being able to, you know, coach and be a part of people's lives and offer teachings and perspective that people do need?
I think I have always been a keen student of what's happening, maybe like a lot of people, because I had to survive. I was moving rather constantly. My parents were moving all around the United States with their profession. And I think you start to pay attention. I have this distinct image of traveling through the lower 48 United States in the backseat of a station wagon. And I'm looking out the window and I'm watching. I'm watching roads. I'm watching towns. I'm looking over at the other car and the people passing by. I'm watching. My siblings were older. They were about a decade older than I was. And so I also watched them. I watched them come and go. My parents traveled a lot. I watched them also come and go. And I asked questions. Whenever my siblings would come back into town, I'd say, hey, tell me about your trip. When my dad came back into town, tell me about where you just went. I was the curious one. I was the one who asked questions. I think that that became a core component of who I was and what I was about. And there was no one who I was more fascinated by than myself. I was very interested in my experience of the world. I wanted to know what was happening for me. And so when I would go through a breakup, I would ask, what happened? What did I just do? Or when I would move and I would feel heartbreak over leaving friends behind, I would ask, like, what is that feeling? Now, I didn't know I was doing anything special, but I think I was born with this kind of curiosity that has been honed over time. I actually didn't go to, I was in my mid-20s before I actually finished my degree or did anything like that. I was actually kind of about the school of life for what seemed like a long amount of time. I was in an intentional community and I traveled all over the world kind of talking to teachers and mentors myself because I was just genuinely fascinated, not just by the human experience, by what we were experiencing here and now, and also the moreness besides. For a long time, that took the role of spirituality. And I was very curious about the more going on, the more than meets the eye quality of this world. And so, yeah, I think that it's taken a lot of different twists and turns going to kind of the Western lens of education and the educational models it offers was one opportunity and option. I think I did a lot of that to please my dad, if I'm really honest, like a lot of men. I was actually just talking about this with my older brother recently. My father passed away 7 months ago, and I was sitting here, and I'm on the eve of publishing my second book, and my first one, As You Are, did quite well, and I was telling my brother, I said, I'm forced to deal with the fact that I have a wildly popular Instagram account that my father unfollowed. I have a book that I know he never opened. I have a degree that I know he didn't actually respect in the end, that I got largely to please him. I said, it's an interesting thing to realize that one of the powerful motivators in your life to do the things you did actually can't give you the attaboy you hoped. So at the end of the day, you better act like, whether they're living or dead, act like your father is dead and begin to do things for yourself. Otherwise, you rack up a lot of mileage for someone else.
From a situational standpoint, though, I always love talking about my old man because I have a really good relationship with him. And it's like, what I thought right away is like, I was like, am I doing that in terms of like your, like what you said, like, am I doing it for his, I'm a hockey player and I'm like always shared that bond with him. And like, he's grown to see me go through all the different stages of playing. And now I'm at this moment of like debating retirement. I'm 31 years old, and it's a factor for me to keep playing. Definitely one of the things that I think about is, well, I'm not going to have that part of our relationship anymore where he's going to get to come watch me play. We're going to be able to talk about our game and things like that. So I guess what I'm sort of thinking is like, sometimes I felt like I was playing hockey out of respect to him and to share that bond and to grow that bond, which comes from like a good hearted place. And I feel like you're talking about your experience from a different lens, but there's sort of similarities with that. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but that's kind of what caught me right away. And it's just, I guess the power of fatherhood is kind of a crazy thing.
Yeah. Tyler, before I launch into a long-winded answer, it felt like there was something on the tip of your tongue maybe you wanted to say as well.
No, I honestly, you might be able to just answer it with your next answer as well, but I'm super curious as to, obviously, you know, because parent and like your parents play such a pivotal role in your life, and I really am curious, obviously, your relationship with your dad and now you being a father, and you have been a father obviously for many, many years, but that self-recognition that you had where it's like, I need to start doing things for myself, you know, like how do you practice that as a father? How do you practice that while also being able to make sure that, you know, your kids always know that you're there, but just remember that dad's going to do some stuff that he enjoys as well. So I guess you might be able to work it into that answer off Riley's as well, but I'll let you have the floor.
Such a great series of questions. This is something I don't actually get to talk about as much, but I'm excited to the next book, not this next one that's coming out, is a book actually about fatherhood and sonship. And so it touches on that theme. I have been a father for 18 and a half years, and I can honestly tell you that what John F. Kennedy said is the truth, that the moment your children are born, they take your heart hostage. And I think that children are so remarkably capable of doing that. Even the way they look up at you with their large doe eyes, they're just drawing you in. In fact, the human child is actually wired from moment one to recruit resources to its cause. That's what a child has to do to survive. That was literally the evolutionary function of those wide eyes, or that coup that draws us in, that takes our heart hostage. And I think of how appropriate it is. Where it gets really mixed up is that oftentimes those resources, we begin to live for them, right? So as a father, I begin to live for my kids. Listen, I would die for my kids, but I can't live for them. Or as kids, we begin to live for our parents. Now that makes a hell of a lot of sense, at least at first. We're developing our first models of how the world works, what it's about, what should I believe, what should be important, who should get my time, who shouldn't. And the first laboratory that we have to conduct these experiments in is our environment. It's our parents, it's our caregivers. So it makes sense that we would develop conclusions and we pander to them. We play to them. We want them on our side. We need them. But we get stuck there sometimes. I think humans are real cute. I had this girlfriend once and we got into a big fight and I was coming back from work to her apartment. When I got there, she had this lasagna and she cuts this big slice of lasagna and she puts it like kind of like slops it on my plate. She stares at me, you know, like real eager. And I say like, what's this? You know, she says, well, it's lasagna. Now I do love a good lasagna. She wasn't wrong, but I didn't understand. And then she says this, she says, that's what my mom did. Every time my parents would get into a real big fight, she'd make my dad lasagna and it would make it better. And then she burst into tears. She started crying and she said, don't you like it? Well, what was she doing? She was borrowing that thing that worked then and there. And surely it will work here and now. I think we're doing this a lot. So we borrow our parents' ideas. We borrow our parents' thoughts, their values, maybe even their lives, because we think it's going to work for us. We think it's going to prevent pain or take us to the next level. And sometimes it does. But a part of growth and development is actually to transcend that which you've learned. It's not to cut away, right? For instance, my child learns to crawl, but now he's walking pretty well. It doesn't mean that he forgot how to crawl. No, he includes that. He transcends but includes, right? And so we want to outgrow our parents. This is one of the thoughts I'm having as my son is now going off to college, his first year away from home, and he's preparing and we're getting him. And you know what? We took him on this huge trip to Spain. We spent 5 weeks in Spain with all four of our kids. I tell you, when you spend 5 weeks abroad, you're no longer on vacation. You're traveling. There's a difference. There's just a quintessential difference. So we're in Spain. We're traveling. I realize he's miserable. And I go, why are you miserable, kid? Don't you know I'm spending a hell of a lot of money on you to be here? Don't you know this is a gift? My God, you ungrateful whelp. And he looks at me and he says, but I only have 2 months left with my girlfriend and I want to get back to her. And I noticed then, you know, when the scale began to tip towards like just like 2 weeks left, 1 week left, 3 days left, he was brightening. Like every day he's getting happier and happier that we're not going to be in Spain anymore. And then he lands and I, honest to God, haven't seen him a day since. He's been camping. He's been at her house. He's been today he showed up at the house. I was like, who are you, kid? He's already gone. He's already gone. And there's a part of me that grieves that. But there's a part of me that says he can't live for me. So I think that all wrapped up in there is probably my answer to your question, that we have to continually confront these realities. Are we living for our parents? Are we living for our children? Mm-hmm. Or is it coming from that unique center where we look into ourselves and we say, what am I here for? What's my job on this earth?
I'm going to tell you a funny story that relates to this. I think it relates to this. You'll tell me if I'm wrong or not. And it's a very, very innocent, low-level version of what you're saying, I think. But my boy was hungry the other day and I had a nice loaf of sourdough bread on the counter and some nice like new Colby Jack cheese. And I was like, man, he's hungry. I know he would love a grilled cheese right now because I love grilled cheese. So I made him up a grilled cheese. I like got it perfect. Like, you know, it was brown, toasty, nice and crunchy, put it on his plate, serve it to him. And he just explodes. He erupts, like just crying, throws the plate away. And I was like, how do you not want a grilled cheese? Like, are you crazy? It's like, this is the best sandwich you can have. But he didn't want grilled cheese. And it's like, in my head, I was like, okay, well, that's a light bulb moment. It's not about what I want. Like, I'll eat the grilled cheese. I want the grilled cheese. But like, he doesn't want that. And I can't push it on him or it's just going to make things worse, you know? And it, like, as funny and as silly as it was, it was kind of like a little bit of that reminder. I mean, he's only one and a half. He was probably a little bit younger at the time, but like, it's just a good reminder that, like, it doesn't matter how much I want something. I'm not here to put what I want to him. Like, he's got to figure it out for himself, and I have to help him as much as I can through that process. So it was kind of funny to me. I was like, kid doesn't want grilled cheese. Are you kidding me?
And, you know, it's funny. Let's extend that, because let's just imagine that. How old's your son?
He's a year and a little over a year and a half.
So let's just imagine that he's now gotten to three, or he's a little older than three, and he can lie. And he can imagine into what you're wanting, and he can change what he's saying to tailor it. And he doesn't want to disappoint dad. And he knows dad loves grilled cheese. And so he takes a bite and he hates it. He hates it. In fact, maybe even he's lactose intolerant or gluten intolerant. But it's like, dad loves grilled cheese and I want to be with dad. And so he's like plastering that smile on his face. And he goes through his whole childhood and gets through all those years eating grilled cheese. And then one day he gets out on his own. And dad cooks up that grilled cheese for him because I know you love grilled cheese, kid. And he says, fuck you, dad. I never liked grilled cheese. You forced it down. Well, hopefully he doesn't have to go that far. But I think that, you know, one of the realities is we really do often get caught in these binds where we keep kind of doing the thing we think that the person we, you know, like want to please wants us to do. And hopefully they're a good caregiver. You know, I'm trying to think of this current experience also with my own kiddo. And I'm kind of chuckling because I think he thinks a lot of things are important to me that aren't about his performance, about what he needs to be about. What he doesn't quite get yet is I just want him to be really astonishingly happy and amazed. Mm-hmm. That's actually all I want.
So to touch on, you know, just even situation with your boy leaving now and going to college, going to, you know, be him and find himself and just be with him. I think there is a lot of parents that are listening or who have been through this experience, whether it's sending their kid off to play sports, whether it's sending their kid off to school, whatever it may be. I mean, I'm not a parent yet. But like I said, I hope there is some parents listening that will be able to relate to this because it is a very real thing. How do you go about that process on a communication level, on a conversation level? And I love your quote of relationship is conversation. I mean, maintaining a relationship where you're not constantly together and where you're not constantly sharing those traditions, those family traditions, those rituals that you always had. Like, what do you think is the best way to continue to go about not strengthening that relationship, but just, you know, keeping that relationship and maintaining that love that you guys have, even though you're not going to have that same day-to-day experience that you once did?
You know, I think you use every available means. I remember having a mentor tell me once, he said, preserve the relationship at all costs. That's a really interesting statement. I'm thinking of a story I heard a while back about a man who heard his son had left his wife, and his son had left his wife for another woman, and this father was very sad about it. And he was an older gentleman, and his son and he were estranged. Somehow or another, he got the idea that he could go and change his son's mind. So he boarded a plane, went all the way and shows up on his son's doorstep, his new doorstep, and actually begs his son to change his mind, tries to convince him, pleads with him, begs him. Son looks at him and says, Dad, I love you, but I'm not actually going to change my mind. The son who related this to me said, when my father died, he died believing that he was a failure because he hadn't convinced me to do the thing he thought was right. The truth is, my dad died my hero because he came to me. Isn't that beautiful? I think that illustrates it for me, that we often think it's about the getting it right, right? If I can just convince them to keep playing hockey, or if I can just convince them to like the grilled cheese sandwich or to go to college or whatever that thing is. I actually think it's about the conversation itself. It's about the dialogue. It's not about where they land. It's about keeping that conversation going. It's about going to them.
It kind of like just fits into that, like even just that role of just being there for someone. And like, I feel like there's so many occasions in life where you can't even like, there's nothing at that time where you can tell them, or like, there's nothing you can say in those instances that's going to make somebody feel better, but just being in the presence and feeling their feelings and like actually trying to like relate in that way. I mean, I even for you, Ty, like you went through something so tragic, and like nothing anybody was going to say to you was going to make that better. And it's just like those moments that you had with people where you like reached a whole nother level of a relationship, right? Because you actually felt their like presence with you. And I think that like, I think that goes hand in hand. What you're saying is just like, I don't know, you don't need to fix it for the person. You just need to sort of be there with the person. So I think that's a good lesson.
This actually ties back to a question, Ty, that you said earlier, like, what's it like to, you know, take these truths and these principles about being human and, you know, all these realities that, you know, I teach on, I talk about, what's it like to work with people around these things, mentor people, all of that. You know, I actually think that the thing we're craving the most is not somebody to fix our fucking problems. We think that's it. I think that we just want someone, as you said, Riley, that's with us in it.
Yeah.
That's with us. And I think that it's funny. We pay professionals for this and we do a lot. I think that there was... I used to be a therapist. I am not a therapist. I used to call myself a coach. I don't know what I would call myself these days. I think the truth is I'm a bit of a friend to people. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not an objective voice in your life. I am a subjective champion of you. I'm a cheerleader. I'm someone who is going to sit beside you and sit with you and be the loudest voice of support in your camp. I'm going to be with you when you're crying. And guess what? You're going to look over and you're going to see me sobbing too. The quality of being with is something we've lost. You know, I was listening recently to one of the proposed changes in the American Psychological Association's recommendations to work with individuals, and one of them had to do with working with people who were racist or who didn't believe in racial equity, and it said you must challenge them, you must intervene, you must. And I absolutely fundamentally believe that racism is a terrible problem, and I think that's something that must be challenged. But I also thought, how interesting that we're losing the ability to actually be with people, right? Now we've got to challenge. Now we've got to fix. Now we've got to dictate how they think and what they do with it. And God, we tamper relentlessly over and over with other people, whether it's friends or parents or providers or healers or helpers. What would happen if we just listened to people? If we were just with one another, elegantly, just with them, had a human experience with them, cried with people who cried, laughed with people who laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It's, no, I'm like, I'm the exact same human being now. I mean, obviously it's maybe 6-7 years ago, you asked me that question or we talk about this and I'd be like, all right, like, let's move on. But now, I mean, I really do think there is so much value and in just listening. And I, even one of the articles that my friend sent me that I always share is just like, being a good listener really does dictate how good that speaker is going to be, especially in a meaningful conversation. And I think that's something that is just so overlooked and is something that I don't think we think about enough, is actually being in a conversation and putting yourself in a conversation, and not so much putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, but just being able to absorb what they're saying. Because I think what I've learned is like absorbing what people are saying and absorbing new perspective can really help with your perspective as well. And your perspective on life, your perspective on tragedy, your perspective just on everything. And I think that's why I put so much emphasis on relationships and conversations now. But I want to, obviously, we do really want to touch on your book, Riley. I don't know if you had anything else before we head into As You Are, but you got anything?
The one theme that I I'm curious about. I think maybe it will tie in organically to the book. So go ahead.
As soon as I saw the book, its title. I think it's obviously a title that just makes you, it's thought provoking instantly. I want to know the origin of that, of just as you are. Like where did that just hit you and you thought to yourself, you know, that's it. Like it's simple, but it just instantly makes you think. Like I just want to know the origin, I guess, of the title.
Going to be disappointing to you.
Hey, that's all right.
I had written the book. I had edited it. I had redacted it. I had shifted it around, and massaged it, done all the things that one does to write a book. And then I had the great task of, after working with my dear friend, who also was the designer, he laid it all out for me. And if you've seen the book, and which you have, and if you've seen the inside, it's a gorgeous book, and I can't claim that I didn't create that design. A lot of people are like, oh, Rainier, I love the design. I'm like, me too. I was so excited to see it. It was really beautiful, and I'm reading it, and then I have the tremendous task of writing an introduction to it. Like, how do I talk about what I'm going to tell you? How do I talk about that? So I write this introduction, and at that point in time, you know, if you don't know the lyrics to a song, sometimes you say watermelon, right? And so at that point in time, I had a like kind of a working title, which I'm not even going to say because it was so bad. I mean, it was just like it was such a throwaway, and I'm so glad it didn't become the title. But I kind of had this knocking around, and I knew I couldn't use it. The designer, who was, again, a very close friend, I sent him over the introduction to add to it. And he said, what are you going to name it after all? I said, I really don't know. I'm still using watermelon, right? And he says, you know, I just read your introduction. I'm sitting here and I'm sobbing. And I said, oh, wow. Well, that, you know, makes me feel like maybe it was a good introduction. And he said, the drum. The steady drum that you hit captures the book so well. And I said, oh, what would you say that drum beat is? And he said, well, just the reminder that as you are is enough. And as soon as I heard that, I went, that's it, as you are. Because it really just summed up everything. And what I didn't realize was I did actually say that phrase four different times in the introduction itself in a very short amount of time. So I was saying it over and over. And when I looked at the book, it was clearly what was jumping out to me. But for whatever reason, it didn't occur to me until I heard it reflected back, which probably goes to the point we were just making about listening and the power of someone reflecting back what we're actually saying. Because then I was able to hear myself think, and that was what came out of it.
Gotcha. That's good. I like that. I don't want this to be a challenging question at all. And I'm in this constant, like, trying to seek that being present, being in the moment, like this, like maybe even like being as I am, just content, comfortable. But there's so much stuff going on, and I just feel like it's for everybody. There's so much stuff going on in life, and to navigate through that with that ability to be present and to be calm and content, it's such a challenge because there's so many distractions, right? Especially now. And I feel like this is kind of a deep question, and there could be so many like different aspects to it, but just like, what are is a pillar or two that you sort of lean on in guiding people to be more at peace with what they have and not in constant comparison to whatever they see on social media or, you know, like their perspective towards money and, you know, like fame, like all these different things that people are really trying to get that can be a bit shallow. I don't know. Like it's kind of a broad question, but what would your pillars be to guiding people to be more at peace?
It's a great question. What I want to say is ditch the idea of being at peace. That's a good first step.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to talk about being as you are, one of the things we have to realize is we're not at peace. We're at war.
Mm-hmm.
We are a mass of conflicting emotions. And part of the tremendous disservice that we do ourselves is we try to cut those away, try to edit those away into a coherent storyline. Be at peace, be happy, be successful, be content, be quiet, sit down. We tell ourselves all the really reasonable things that were told to us by our teachers, by our parents, by our politicians, by our priests, by our pastors to make sense. God, please, somebody tell that kid just to be at peace, just to fucking rest. And so we cut away. We eliminate so many parts of ourselves. And we lose access to those parts. I don't know that someone should be at peace. Quite frankly, I think that we're trying to wander around a very turbulent world right now, telling people that they should keep calm and carry on. I'm not sure they should keep calm. Like the 1960s bumper sticker said, if you're not terrified, if you're not angry, if you're not frustrated, if you're not, you name it, you're not paying attention. Maybe at peace isn't what anybody should be right now. Maybe right. The most intellectually honest thing that we should do is to say, actually, I have a hell of a lot of anxiety happening right now every time I even wake up in the morning. And actually, I can't even pay my bills. And I got to think about how I'm going to sign up for DoorDash later so that I can keep on doing the thing that I love. And right. Sometimes I have artists come to me and they're like, God, how do I make my painting my primary thing? And I'm like, why the hell would you want to do that? God, you miss out on so much life by not working at Starbucks anymore. Do you know how many conversations you can have at Starbucks that are going to inform your art? Oh my God, don't take yourself out of it. We're trying to eliminate realities. The first place I would say to start if you want to have peace is eliminate the idea of having peace. Instead, acknowledge. Radical acceptance does not mean approving of what is, it means acknowledging what is. And so where I start, you ask for a pillar, where I start is I say, what is? Well, I feel anxious. What do I mean by that? That's a weird word, anxious. God, that's a diagnostic term. That word means nothing. That's milquetoast. If I have 10 people show up and say I'm anxious, then I have 10 different definitions because that means something else. How do you know you're anxious and not just having indigestion? I want to know what anxious means to you. Where do you feel it? Where in your skin? Where on your body? What's the thought you're having right now? What does it make you want to do? Right? Get granular with your experience. Don't be at peace. Notice the armies that are at war instead. Right. See the competing impulses. That's what I would say. I would actually say, begin to get very interested about your full experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know what you were asking, by the way, but that was the roundabout way to get.
No. I think that's such a good answer too. And I mean, like as you were talking, I kind of was my language of my question. I wish I maybe framed it in a different way because it's almost at peace is probably like, it would maybe emotional stability be the thing to be seeking, like where you're able to feel. And I feel like I've lost that playing hockey because it's just a roller coaster ride. And not just saying hockey is, you know, like everybody deals with this. And I feel like it's a very common problem is to just not have that ability to feel, like feel happiness, feel sadness, feel jealousy, feel, because you just put it aside as soon as it hits you. And maybe that's a common problem. I don't know if that's a common problem that you see among the conversations you have and the people that you talk to, but it's a sad thing, but it's kind of reality, right? So it's a bit about navigating through that, I think, is more of what came to my head.
First of all, Riley, you ask it exactly as I would have hoped. You couldn't have teed me up better had we planned that. but second of all, what I actually just want to say is what you just said is so powerful. Lost the ability to feel. Lost the ability to feel something meaningful. You know, Brené Brown said, and I think I really agree with her, you can't cut away one emotion without cutting away all the others. So we want to feel happy, so we cut away the sadness. But then we end up not feeling very happy. Mm-hmm. You actually have to accept the whole. You have to be willing to sit with what is. Now, I want to say something specific to y'all. Y'all is a Southern word here. I don't know if you have that in Canadian. Yeah. By the way, my ex-wife was Canadian and my kids are dual citizens. So I is familiar with Canada. What I want to say about athletes is that the athletes are almost taught from day one to perform, to cut away what's happening on their bodies, because your bodies have to become a machine. To cut away their emotions, because you have to execute the instructions. My wife played college basketball and full ride scholarships, star athlete. And she tells me that one day she simply realized the cost was she lost access to her heart. And so I do think, and I'm giving a specific message to a very specific population, that I think a lot of people who play high level athletics or who have been in that world, one of the costs of doing business was you had to become a bit of a machine. Now I'm going to apply that to the rest of the population. I think the trauma response to living in the world we're living today is to cut away access to our hearts. We almost have to become an icy brick just to make it, right?
Yeah.
We have to guard our hearts and protect our hearts and hide our hearts, because if we don't, we're going to step outside the front door and get bulldozed by a Mack truck of the world that we live in. Some of it's appropriate, by the way. Some of it we'd actually do want to be a little armored in life. Not everyone should get all of me. I think, you know, sometimes like I hear people say, I'm going to be completely authentic. I'm going to tell everyone what's on my mind. I'm like, please don't. Please don't. Not everyone can hold you. Not everyone deserves to be able to have that opportunity. So you really do have to know when to and when not to. But what you want is access. And so how you begin to develop that access is you begin to pay attention. And for some of us, we've been so cut off from places that you're actually going to have to let your gaze linger overly long. So let's just say, and I know this isn't a problem with hockey players, but let's just say that you lost access to anger. Now, I have known a lot of hockey players in my life, and I will say that is one emotion I've never thought they've been cut off from. They always had a good chance of accessing anger more than I did as a kid for whatever reason. And I love that about hockey players. They were like the angriest bunch of guys I knew. I was roommates with a whole bunch of them. And what I will say is that, but I wasn't. And for me, anger was like an unacceptable emotion to show at home. I couldn't be angry. I couldn't ever get angry. And why? Because if I did, my dad would get even more angry and I wouldn't win that fight. So I learned pretty quickly to stuff, to suppress, to cut away, to hide it, right? Just to make it. And eventually, I stopped even being able to get to that emotion. So think about that logic chain, right? I don't want to throw the dishes in the middle of a fight because I'll have to pick it up. Okay, that makes sense. I don't want to pick up the dishes, so I'm not going to throw the dishes. Pretty smart. But I don't even want to get close to throwing the dishes, so I'm not even going to allow myself to get angry. And so then I completely cut away that emotion. Well, then what happens? Well, I can tell you what happened in my life. My ability to accomplish goals, my ability to get through hard things, to have emotional toughness or resiliency, my ability to make it past a threat was so emaciated, so limp that I couldn't penetrate the world around me. I actually couldn't execute the things that needed to be in front of me. Life is hard. And I didn't have the capacity to meet it on its own terms because I didn't have access to the emotion of anger. And anger helps you get across a finish line. So what did I have to do? I had to replug into anger. And one of the things I had to do, I had to sit down and say, what should I feel angry about? But I might not. And you know what I learned? I learned that I was plugging the anger cord into the sadness wall. A lot of things that I was feeling sad about, I probably should have felt angry about. And I began to allow myself to say, I feel anger. I didn't at first, but I said it. And as I allowed myself to say it, and as I allowed myself to notice it, I began to have access to it, bit by bit by bit.
That's so interesting, because I think, I mean, from what I've learned is individuals just like, we have such a hard time as an individual to allow, like, give ourselves permission to access those emotions and to access what we really actually need to feel in that moment. Just because, well, you're thinking about somebody else, or where you're thinking about how are they going to perceive me? And I mean, there's so many thoughts that instantly enter your mind when you should be actually allowing yourself that permission. I mean, I think that was such an excellent way to just wrap this up, because emotion is such a real thing. And I think Riley hit that nail on the head, is we've lost that. We've lost that touch with our own emotion, and we've lost being able to really be fully aware of what emotion we need to feel at that certain time, and instead of rather just pushing it off and maybe feeling it later on. So, Riley, I'm not sure if you had anything else, but I again, Rainier, that was a lot of fun, and that was a lot of fun, but it was also very real. And I think that's exactly what we both know we were going to get out of today was, you're Rainier Wild. And I think we can't thank you enough for what you do. And anybody, for everybody listening, please go check out As You Are. And yeah, I mean, wow, that was awesome.
Your name fits like your, I don't want to say like aura might be the wrong word, but just like, as you like speak and everything, I'm like, that's a badass name. You're a badass dude. And it was fun to like put some deeper conversation together. Like, we don't necessarily have these with all of our guests. We're trying to sort of map out life and just be open, and especially as men too. But it was nice to hear like kind of a bit of the root to a lot of, I don't want to say our issues, but a lot of what goes on in our head, to hear the root and to hear the sort of meaning as to what's going on. So yeah, we thank you a ton. This was a lot of fun.
It's a blast, you guys. Anytime you want to hang out, just let me know. Now, let's see, in Calgary, years ago, there was a wrap shop. Do you guys remember wraps? Like sandwiches, but like in a tortilla? And it was called Badass Jack's.
Badass Jack's. Oh, yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Is that place still around? I think that was many, many years ago.
I'd have to look it up. I haven't seen a Badass Jack's around here, but there was a Badass Jack's in Spruce Grove, Alberta, like not far from where I grew up. And we used to go after all of our hockey games, Badass Jack's.
That's great, man. I remember that. Awesome. I feel like I'm looking at myself in the reflection in the monitor right now, and I'm thinking, do I look like the character from Badass Jack's, who was like the actual mascot? Just maybe a little.
Well, Rainier, thank you again, my man, and we will talk to you very soon.
See ya.
This episode is also brought to you by BioSteel. Zero sugar, essential electrolytes, great taste, and pure hydration. Join the likes of Connor McDavid, Alec Manoah, Andrew Wiggins, Brooke Henderson, and Patrick Mahomes on the BioSteel train. It's time for you to try BioSteel with our SYM25 discount code that will get you 25% off at checkout. Yep, that's right. I will gladly attest to this being the best hydration drink on the market. SYM25 at checkout.